Recordings has been started.
Thank you very much, Christine. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the IGO-INGO QoT Device Protection PDP Working Group call on the 2nd of March 2016. On the call today, we have George Kirikos, Jim Bykoff, Phil Corwin, Petter Reinforth, David Maher, Jay Chapman, Reg Levy, Paul Keating. We received apologies from Mason Cole and Osvaldo Novoa. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, and myself, Marky Pervin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Phil.
Okay. Phil here, and welcome all. I don't know how you want to proceed. We've all received the synopsis, which is a very brief condensation of a long draft memo that Mary and Steve and Petter and I reviewed. We're not able to share it with you at this time. The professor doesn't want something floating around with his name on it that's not final, and we respect that, but that's why we asked for a synopsis. But let me start just by, summarizing kind of a synopsis of the synopsis. Basically, he said the question of IGO immunity is complicated. It depends on a multiplicity of factors. I think that in itself is helpful because the feedback we've gotten from the IGOs, to the extent we've gotten anyway, has pretty much been it's a black and white issue and there's nothing to discuss. I think this helps refute that position. There's not even a clear stand on this in the United States. It depends on which circuit you're in, and then he gets into the UDRP issue, and whether or not the waiver that's inherent with filing a UDRP where you consent to mutual jurisdiction is a violation of sovereign immunity if it exists for that case. So then he gets into alternatives. I'm not sure we there seemed to be some feedback on the list. We really don't want him to get into proposing alternatives unless we, I guess the only alternative this group has thought about would be if we found that the waiver that's inherent in filing a UDRP is clearly violative of established sovereign immunity rights, then we'd have to think seriously about establishing a different curative rights protection mechanism for IGOs, but I'm not sure we want the professor, or at least we've gotten feedback about him proposing kind of compromises within the existing system. But I'll stop there. You've all read the synopsis. It's only two pages. Most of your lawyers are do a good impersonation of being a lawyer in this field, and why don't we open it for discussion, not just what you think of the synopsis and where it's taking us, but how we should frame Wednesday's discussion in Marrakesh in the most useful way for advancing the work of this working group, which now we may have a path to finishing that work by ICANN 56, which will be somewhere. It won't be in Panama City, but we'll be somewhere probably in June, maybe in July, who knows, but it's a few months away, 3 to 4 months off. So I'll stop there and and if you're, is there anyone who's not in the chat room, who's on the phone line?
I'm just on the phone line, Phil. It's Jim Bykoff.
Okay. So, Jim, if you want to say something, just chime in. Anyone else, please raise your hand, and we'll set up a queue.
Thanks.
And does Petter have any introductory remarks? I don't want to monopolize the intro.
No, I think it's good as you did, and it's also counting from the initial discussion when we sent out this memo, as you pointed out, this is not his full expert comments. It's just the summarizing of that we asked him to send out. So we have seen a number of interesting and also useful notes in his draft report that I hope we will have do you remember when we will have it ready to discuss and look at it? Will it be for next week?
Well, Petter, he didn't give us a firm date, but you know what I heard from when we talked to the professor about 10 days ago. You know, with the feedback we give him from whatever happens in Marrakesh, I think we certainly expect a final draft before the end of March.
Oh, Phil, it's Jim Bykoff.
Yeah.
Just one comment. Until we receive the full opinion, I assume that this synopsis, you know, that there may be changes to the opinion, even though this is a very brief synopsis. How can we really discuss, you know, what he's going to provide us with in final until we see it? You know, there may be changes in it. He may change some conclusions. He's got some hypotheticals in here, and he also has some things that I think are beyond the mandate in terms of alternatives. So I wonder how much we can do until we have the whole opinion.
Well, you know, we got the synopsis. You know, it was the professor, because of his academic load, was not going to be able to complete the draft, which is, as I remember, 23 to 24 pages right now, heavily footnoted. It's a very good resource document on this subject. I don't, you know, maybe the best thing ever written, because it's such an obscure subject, you know, the interplay between IGO immunity and this ICANN arbitration process. So my sense, and Marion Petter, you know, jump in if you think I'm wrong, is that it's not likely that's going to change much. What was missing from that document were upfront a summary conclusions and a more full-fledged, you know, fleshed-out conclusions portion at the end. So I don't expect any significant deviation from in terms of major conclusions from what you see in the document. And, in fact, if we get back to him and say, hey, you know, this idea of proposing some other arbitration system that's beyond what we're asked for and paying for, and the working group really decided they don't want that, that makes it a lot easier for him to finish up quickly.
Thanks.
Okay, see hands up, Paul, and then followed by George. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, this is Paul Keating. You can hear me fine?
Yes, we
can. I have a history of bad. Okay, good. So I guess partly in answer to the prior comments, from my standpoint, I'm glad we saw the synopsis, because I think it does allow us to guide him to make sure that we receive something that that really is useful and on point. In reverse order, I think we should tell him that suggestions as to an arbitration methodology are way outside of the scope of what I thought we asked him, and I really want him to eliminate that discussion, because it's premature, right? And I think that that is an issue for another day if it arises. The second point that I wanted to get to was, I would very much, having read this synopsis, I think that it suffers from a lack of detail, right? And obviously it's a synopsis, but based upon your comments, Phil, that you don't expect there to be any changes. I mean, one of the things I think I would appreciate if you went back and told him was, listen, for guidance purposes, please give the essence of the cases that he's referring to, and why he believed that they supported one way or the other. For example, the qualified immunity, where is the threshold in these cases? Because that will allow us to discern the nuances that I predicts, based on his synopsis, he's going to come up with. You know, it's kind of, there are three, you know, there's absolute immunity, there's qualified immunity, and there's no immunity, right? So I would like to see him deal with the case law more, or other authority more, in dealing with those three options, so that we can then assess which of them apply, or whether we agree that with his assessment of which of them might apply. And that's my comment. I'll go back on mute. Hello? Did I lose everyone on the call?
Oh, sorry. I was talking on mute. This is Phil.
No. I just didn't hear any response at all. It's just,
oh, I was responding, but
it's not uncommon to my comments.
With the mute button on, I think when you see the final memo, it is very documented with case law to the extent there is case law, and it's more nuanced. So I think that's addressed. But, again, you know, we're going to get a final draft, and I think, as I understand, Mary, you know, or certainly I wanted this group to have a chance to comment on that final draft and get some feedback to the professor before we actually publish this paper to a wider audience. So next, George. Please enlighten us, George.
George Karikos here. I wanted to agree with the points that Paul raised and that Jim had raised earlier. We don't want the professor to be a policy member of our group. We wanted to consult him as an independent person providing us with facts, which from doing a survey of, you know, international law. And so what I was expecting, I don't know if these appear in the footnotes, would be, you know, explicit citations of case law in, you know, the various top countries that are available, you know, Canada, United States. We've already found some from Canada and United States before in our research, but presumably he'd be doing a more broader survey of those kinds of decisions in different countries. Like when we originally proposed doing the research ourselves, you know, supposedly one of the ICANN lawyers would have done like a search on Westlaw or some of the other legal databases, but I guess that never worked out, and that's how the idea arose to farm it out to an independent expert. Having seen those, the 23 pages, are those the kinds of things that he's been doing?
Kind of, George, what kind of things are you referring to? Just so I'm clear on the question.
Okay, for example, the Supreme Court of Canada decision talking about that the sovereign immunity isn't absolute, and so presumably there are similar decisions in other countries that support that kind of view, and perhaps there are decisions in other countries that are, you know, at variance with that decision, and so there wouldn't be a consensus as to what that view might be.
You know, I don't recollect whether he cites a specific Supreme Court or Canada case, but there's a lot of cases cited in the memo. There's a lot of footnoting.
Are they international cases, or all from the United States?
No. They're not just U.S. cases. But again, when we get the final draft, we think he missed an important case that we know of. We'll have a chance to provide that feedback.
Okay. I guess, like the George Karikos speaking again. I guess the ultimate question we wanted him to allow us to help decide is, you know, let's say a hypothetical example is I walk by the World Bank and throw a rock at their window and I break it. And let's say there's a videotape and everybody knows I broke it. What could the World Bank do? Could they force me into an international arbitration? That's essentially what they're asking us as a policy group for the EDRP to say that some person that they want to initiate a complaint against must be forced into an arbitration. And I think the answer from what he said is no. So if they could take on that kind of a hypothetical, like the person who throws a rock might be liable in a criminal case, you know, brought by the government in the jurisdiction he's located. But to bring a civil case to, you know, repair the cost of the window, I would think that naturally the IGO would have to give up their immunity in order to go to the court to seek those civil damages. And otherwise, we'd be making new law if we did anything at variance with that kind of existing standard. And, you know, one might say, too bad, you know, that's what the state of the law is. And, you know, it's not as though they said, well, we think we could do better than that, but, you know, that if that's the state of the law, then we shouldn't go beyond that. Because IGOs don't just have it might suffer a disadvantage from not being able to pursue that case, but it's kind of symmetric because let's say they do something bad, like let's say a worker at an IGO commits a crime, they're actually immune from from justice, so it's kind of offset. So they might be, you know, they might have sympathy that they may not be able to pursue a certain claim for, you know, UDRP or whatever without waiving their immunity. But, you know, the fact that they're able to assert their immunity in cases that cry out for justice, I think kind of counterbalances that.
Yeah. Well, George, just if you were on the sidewalk in Washington, D.C. and threw a rock through the World Bank window, you'd be immediately arrested by the numerous police who are around there. I'm not sure if they're federal or D.C. and whether you'd be tried in a D.C. municipal court or in some federal court. The civil thing, which this is more akin to civil, where the
that's my point. That on a civil basis, the World Bank couldn't force me to pay them $10,000 or whatever to replace the window.
Well, I don't know of an arbitration procedure that would allow that kind of claim. So I think in that case they'd have to bring an action, you know, in a court of law. But let's move on to some others. Paul, I'm just going to let Petter jump in here since you already spoke, and then go back to you. So, Petter, why don't you go ahead?
Petter, I just wanted to note that he actually, in his draft, have realized that national law may determine the immunity of international organizations, and he gives some examples of that. So, as said, once we have the full report, I think that you can, some of the questions and the additions you wanted to have are more or less in there, but it's good to have feedback from what he may clarify more of that.
Okay, thank you, Petter. Paul?
Yes, this is Paul Keating. I think we ought to stay away from the concept of criminality because it just mucks up the water. But I believe I read when I first passed through this, his synopsis, that he does deal with the distinction of the domain registrant being forced into this process by contract. But I think he might, you know, he might, his research report might benefit from setting forth in the beginning the clear set of facts that we are all dealing with, yeah? So it is domain name registrant registers the domain name. He agrees to the terms of the registration agreement, which incorporates the UDRP. And that's the facts on his side. The facts on the IGO NGO side is they've obtained a trademark or are asserting a common law trademark or service mark, and they are utilizing the third party beneficiary, this contractual provision, to attempt to take away this domain name on the grounds of that are set forth in the UDRP. That's really the only factual scenario we're dealing with. And then the issue is the assertion of mutual jurisdiction within the context of the UDR complaint, is that a waiver, right? That's really that's the factual scenario we're dealing with. We're not dealing with anything else. And I think, George, we ought to stay away from, you know, things that are factual patterns that are a little bit more insightful, like throwing rocks through people's windows. I mean, that just comes up with the wrong idea. And we should ought to stay away from, you know, cyber squatters and things like that. It's a neutral fact pattern. This domain name could be anything, and it could be good faith or bad faith. It doesn't matter. So I think he would benefit from setting that forth. And, you know, I'll go so far as to say, I think, in response to what Petter said, I think that he's going to come out, or he has pretty much concluded that whether or not there's a waiver of immunity depends upon where the action is brought. Yeah, and if that's the case, then I would like the group to consider an alternative approach to the recommendations, which is that the UDRP, when and if the UDRP amendment process comes about, that serious consideration be given to beefing up the language of the UDRP concerning the mutual jurisdiction to us to actually include an assertion that it's a waiver of immunity and it's a waiver of forum non-convenes and jurisdictional issues, because that's what the intention of the original drafters was, is to provide the registrant with a clear path. If you go there, your domain will not be taken, and you will be able to proceed under those national laws to state whatever claim you have. Right? So those are my two cents worth, but I think that he would benefit, we would all benefit in reading his final report if he clearly set forth the factual synopsis with which we're dealing. And that's it.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Phil here. And just before getting back to Petter, I haven't looked at the phone memo in a while, so I forget exactly how he treats that. But I can assure you that in both my initial face-to-face meeting with him and in the call we had with him about 10 days ago, he understands that not only that the registrant must accept, submit to a potential UDRP filing and under their registration contract, but that he understands that ICANN is not a government agency or an international agency, that it's a California nonprofit corporation. And I've certainly raised with him the issue of, even if ICANN said, even if ICANN adopted some procedure that said to a registrant, if an action is against brought against you by an IGO in general or by this type of IGO, you don't have access to court. Any appeal is to, this arbitration proceeding or whatever, that that ICANN one doesn't have power to extinguish any nationality's law. It's bound to respect legal rights, but it can't create them, and that the registrant could readily go to a court when there's an applicable law like the ACPA in the U.S. and say, "Hey, I've got these legal rights. They're trying to transfer my domain, and I'm asserting my rights under U.S. law. And this, nonprofit corporation in California has no power to deny me access to statutory law as a U.S. citizen." So he's aware of that scenario and the issues it raises. So back to Paul. I see Paul's hand up.
Yeah, this is Paul Keating again. I might agree with you, but if that were said and stated in the context of a revised UDRP, every single registrant who clicked renewal or registration after that date would certainly be bound by that waiver, because it's a contractual obligation. I can contractually throw away my rights, and then you'd have to go in and analyze it under typical browse wrap, click wrap type contractual analysis to see whether or not that provision was binding or not. But I think conceivably it certainly could be done, depending upon how they did it. You have to remember that this whole domain process, everything we talk about domains, is all based entirely upon contract. It's not based upon any legal statute whatsoever. It's all contractual, all the way down to ICANN. So we have to be careful saying what legal rights we do and we don't have. We have legal rights, but they're pursuant to contract. They're not pursuant to anything else, other than general principles of property law. But to the extent that contract that we all sign as registrants deviates from what the legal standard is, then unless we're dealing with something that cannot be waivable in a forum jurisdiction as a matter of public policy, I think you might have waived it under the contract analysis.
Yeah, Well, I'm going to disagree a little bit, Paul. At least in the United States, there are statutory rights. There's the Anti-Prescribing Protection Act, and any potential complainant could decide to go directly to court and not bring a UDRP. And any registrant who feels that a UDRP decision is trying to unfairly, you know, is trying to take their domain away in a way that violates that statute has access to the courts. So I'm not, I'm not sure. There's other arbitration laws in the U.S., and the memo doesn't deal with them, but I'm not sure this is the type of consent that would be recognized by the U.S. courts and enforced against the registrant. That's a different legal issue. But again, I think for our working group, the question boils down to is whether when an IGO files a UDRP and consents to mutual jurisdiction, is that waiver of immunity, which is part and parcel of filing UDRP, so violative of clearly recognized sovereign immunity rights that it would justify establishing a separate curative rights procedure just for them? And I think we ought to stick to that issue. That's the reason we contracted with an outside expert. Petter?
Just want to mention one interesting thing I saw in this report was a reference to the United Nations and Article 105 of the Charter that that says that United Nations shall enjoy immunity from every form of legal process, except insofar as in any particular case it has expressly waived its immunity. So that's actually for United Nations. And what I think we can, if we take it in the more easy way, we can be may be able to use it as if you are an IGO and you have either registered a domain name or you file for a UDRP, that means that you have expressly also accept that you have waived the immunity.
Okay. Thank you, Petter. George again.
Yeah, I just if you go back to the email that sent yesterday, the World Bank even recognizes that they can explicitly waive their immunity. So I don't think that that's a big issue. We have the example of Argentina, for example, sovereign countries waiving their immunity in regards to their bond offerings. They explicitly recognized the New York courts, and of course there was a big lawsuit that ensued when they defaulted on their obligations, and the thing is apparently being settled this month. So it would be a very odd situation where creatures that are created by treaties, i.e. IGOs, would have immunity that the sovereign nations themselves don't have. Like if, you know, the government of Brazil or some other country wanted to go after a domain name, they would have to waive their immunity in the same manner. But why would the IGOs have a higher immunity than the actual sovereign countries that created them?
In fact, sorry, I think that's what GEC has stated in an informal way to us as well.
All right. And thing is, it's a slippery slope. George Kourikos again. It's a slippery slope. If something special was carved out for the IGOs, the question is, who's next? Obviously, the governments would want that. Who else would want that? And then you'd see a whole scenario where brand new law is being created that doesn't exist for any other assets in the real world. Or sorry, in the offline world or whatever, non-domain name world.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, George. I'm going to take the chair's privilege here and make a comment. It's interesting to me. Again, I'm in general agreement with the group that we didn't ask him to propose and design a separate arbitration procedure. And we probably for this, if we don't want to go there, and for the sake of getting this memo finalized as soon as possible, we're probably going to ask him not to expend any further effort on that. But I found it very interesting in the last paragraph in the synopsis, which kind of begins to talk about, you know, if you're going to design a separate CRP just for IGOs or certain types of IGOs, what would be required? And I think, you know, that has to be considered as well, what that task would entail. And, you know, it would involve such factors as whether or not it was a UN-affiliated IGO or a non-UN IGO. So we could have a procedure just for the UN affiliate, but not for the other IGOs. I can imagine the dispute within ICANN and the GAC on that. It might depend where the registrant resided or the registrar, which would in turn determine the mutual jurisdiction, and whether or not the immunity would be recognized there, but that would put ICANN in a position of somehow trying to prejudge, and as he puts it, potentially misconstrue immunity in a particular jurisdiction. So I think it just, that last paragraph, and there's more in the full memo, points out that the myriad policy issues and complications of going toward designing a new CRP if we ever decided that was necessary. And probably the result would be something that the GAC and IGOs wouldn't be happy with because it would be so complicated and depend on a multiplicity of factors. Okay. See some comments in the chat. Rudy's put in a couple about interplay with national law, and of course, I just refer to that. And you know, as the synopsis in the full memo points out, there's no uniform consensus view globally on the scope of IGO immunity. It's different in different national jurisdictions based on their own case law. And there's probably a bunch where it's never been considered. Okay. And George, you asked, you wanted to, I don't know that we want to vote here. This meeting wasn't for taking votes. I think we want this to be a preliminary discussion to get initial reactions to the synopsis and get an idea of how we want to proceed in Marrakesh. The way I envision it is that after we have that fuller discussion in Marrakesh, where hopefully some GAC members and IGOs will be present as well, then we can give him consensus feedback from the working group as to how we'd like him to finish the memo. Is that acceptable to the working group? I think we'll probably wind up telling him not to go down the road of trying to construct an alternative arbitration process. That wasn't a question we asked him or a goal we asked him to entertain. Well, I see no other hands up. I'm not hearing anyone speak, so it's 12:37. Before we end this, do people have anything to say about thoughts about how the meeting should proceed at Marrakesh? I believe we'll distribute or have available the synopsis for participants physically at the meeting, and we'll display it for those remotely participating. We'll review the synopsis. We'll make clear that this is just a very boiled down summary of a much more lengthy and heavily footnoted draft memo, and then try to talk about where folks think that these findings should take the working group in completing its work. And George was asking, the meeting next week is, right now, Mary had indicated that it may be changed to a somewhat, to a mid-morning time slot, which actually would be advantageous. It would not conflict with a GAC meeting taking place. But right now it's scheduled for 9 a.m. Local time in Marrakesh next Wednesday, which I'm not sure of the time difference between Marrakesh and East Coast U.S. I think it's at least 4 to 5 hours. So it's in the middle of the night on the East Coast. Sorry about that, but nothing. We have no influence over the scheduling of these things.
Phil, Jim Bykoff, do you think it might be advisable to remove point two from the synopsis, since from what I've heard, we're saying that this may go beyond the mandate, and just give people the synopsis, paragraph one.
You know, Mary and Petter, what do you think about that? To me, you know, my initial reaction is that we would need, since the professor's name is on this, we would need his permission, or at least discuss it with him before we would have, you know, I don't feel like we have the authority to edit a synopsis that has his name on it. We could tell him that the initial reaction of our working group is that they don't want to him to go down the road of trying to draft a provision for arbitration for certain types of IGOs. We're not at that point yet of even deciding that's necessary. But I think we need his consent to do that.
I didn't mean Phil to do it without his consent. My thought was that we would ask him to remove that from and have a revised synopsis. I think it's misleading to distribute something to people who may attend that meeting in which they think that this is part of what he's going to be giving a full opinion on, if he's not, since it hasn't been decided yet. You know, it might, people may think that this is part of the mandate.
Well, certainly, at a very minimum, I'd like to see the last sentence of that, where he promises to provide a draft provision for an arbitration system. I think that's putting the cart in front of the horse. There's no reason to start designing such a system unless this working group decides that the scope of sovereign immunity requires it for at least some IGOs. Yeah.
So this is
I say Paul, and then Petter after Paul.
I agree with Jim completely. I think that we ask him just to end it after the last paragraph of one, for a number of reasons. One, it's outside of the scope, number one. And number two, more importantly, if I were at that meeting and I was not involved in this work group, that's the only thing I'd button you all on. I mean, and there'd be 45 minutes of conversation about the possibilities of number two, and you'd have to backpedal and say, no, we haven't. We have asked him not to do that, exactly. So I think it's easier if you just send him an email or talk to him on the phone and say, please just resend it, but just without paragraph two, right? Just cut it short, two paragraphs and a sentence. I think you're just leading people on in a misleading way. This is a subject matter for the working group, but I don't believe it is. It's going to expand the nature of conversations, overwhelm the concerns of people that may be in the audience, and just cause a lot of problems that don't need to be caused. So I would ask you that you go back to him and ask him just to reprint you one, you know, and take the 30 minutes it would take to cut out the last two paragraphs.
Well, I'm going to be a bit contrarian on this and you know, waiting for feedback from you and from Petter, but I think the first paragraph of two is somewhat beneficial. It could be recast a bit, such as any alternatives would require a consideration of a, you know, multiplicity of considerations. But that first paragraph is the one that notes the involuntary submission to the UDRP by the registrant. It brings that in. So I'm more bothered by the second paragraph, which gets into more detail about Unsertrel arbitration and then goes on to promise a draft provision. I think putting that out there and then not having that draft provision creates problems down the road. Or maybe we just eliminate two, and the first paragraph of one is of two is recast a bit, just to point out the multiple considerations that would arise in constructing any unique CRP for IGOs.
Bill, it's Jim Bykoff. I think that's the preferable way to go. Rather than leak two in, I think you may want to just add a sentence in one, if the professor agrees.
Okay.
Fine.
Okay. I still see Paul's hand up. Paul, was that an old hand or a new one? And then I also see Petter's hand up. Okay, Paul's gone. Petter.
Your hand. I just had one thought, if it could be a possibility to still have some part of paragraph two with a, maybe just three or four sentences very summarized to mention that there are alternatives and short plus and minus of them that could even be in, I mean, instead of having point one and point two, he could have one point, so to speak, but that number two was like some addition to the initial. I don't know if it's possible without confusing readers that haven't been involved in this discussion before, but still it's as for him as an expert, outside expert, it could be good to provide just a quick output on what kind of alternatives there are, and then for us to decide what's the best way to proceed.
Yeah, again, I'm not that bothered. I agree, Petter. I'm not that. The first paragraph of two basically notes that you know, IGOs generally deal with the immunity issue by in bilateral contracts asking the other party to consent to another arbitration process. And then he notes that this situation is different because it's a tripartite arrangement where there's also a registrant who was forced into submitting to UDRP jurisdiction when they registered and would be compelled to, if there was something, another arbitration other than access to their courts, would be compelled to do that. And then he also notes that going down that road would require much greater compliance efforts by ICANN than it presently has. I think all of that is just a discussion of what, you know, that is in the memo where he discusses what IGOs do now, and that's what we asked him to look at that. So my problem is more with the second paragraph or two, where he starts going down the road of proposing an alternative and promises that the draft memo will include, you know, suggestions for such an alternative. And to me, until this group decides whether or not any anything along those lines is justified based on our reading of existing law on sovereign immunity, that's, you know, we shouldn't be even hinting at going down that road before we've made that decision, and we can't make that decision until we see the full memo, the full final memo, after we comment on it. So it's really putting that last paragraph is the one that puts the cart before the horse and promises things that we don't want him to engage in at this time.
Phil, I have got to get off the call. I'll just make my last comment, and that is that I disagree with having two in there at all. I think you can add a sentence to one, but starting to get into alternatives at a point where that is beyond the scope, I think either two has to, if you want to have a sentence in two, it has to be completely rewritten, or you should add it to one. There's no reason to have a separate two at this point. I think it's premature. And until we see the full report, I think, you know, there will be adjustments made based on what I've heard today. I just think it's wrong to have that two in there. So with that, I'll leave and leave it to the rest of the folks to comment.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Bye. Bye, all.
Well, this is Mary.
Yes, Mary.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just want to chime in here and to say a couple of things that given the time where we are and that the meeting is coming up, in fact, and Steve has just boarded his plane and I'm leaving for the airport in 15 minutes, that it might be easiest to let the professor know that subject to his consent, we will be circulating more broadly this synopsis without the paragraph two or with only part of paragraph two, perhaps removing the numbering, as Jim has suggested, simply because it might be quite difficult for you or Peter or any of us to do much more back and forth in the next couple of days. I think that having him redraft or amend the synopsis at this stage might be more complicated and might take longer than we would need. So that would be my suggestion, to circulate a shortened version of this memo. Secondly, in terms of the scope, I think that from what we could see from the longer draft memo, the professor does go into some detail about why he approached it the way he did and why he still tried to answer our central questions. And hopefully working group members will see when that memo is finalized that what he talks about here in paragraph two isn't perhaps as extreme or as unexpected as it might appear in this brief page document. So, Phil, those are my suggestions and a comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful, Mary. You know, just think about this logistically. You're leaving for the airport in 15 minutes. You'll be arriving in Marrakesh about the time I'm leaving tomorrow. Then I get there Friday afternoon. I'm not sure when Petter gets there. We can hear from him in a minute. So just logistically, the first time that the co-chairs and staff would have a chance to all discuss a potential edit of two and then have to propose it to the professor and get his permission would be over the weekend when I'll be up to my eyeballs in council meetings all weekend. It may just be easier to ask the professor if it's okay that we, for our discussion purposes in Marrakesh, we decide it would be better just to provide his synopsis with section one and delete section two at this time because the working group has not reached any decision to pursue an alternative process.
Bill, this is Paul Keating. So,
yeah,
sorry,
can I just, Paul, just before you speak? Petter, when do you okay, Petter, you get there Saturday afternoon, so you won't be there with me Saturday morning. I present the update to the council.
Oh, of course I do.
What's that?
No, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, that's further logistical complications for trying to propose an edit of all of two to the professor and get it approved. So we may just ask him, tell him, you know, that we're going to delete all of section two for purposes of our working group meeting next Wednesday and just make sure that's okay with him. Yeah, go ahead now, Paul.
I'm sorry, Phil, for jumping in before. This is Paul Keating again. as a compromise, it's fine with me if you just delete the last paragraph, you know, that starts, I can, could also adopt, as you suggested. I'm willing to live with number two because it has enough in it that
clearly allows you to state to anybody in the audience that, listen, there's no way you could do this without a rehaul of the EBRP because of those contractual issues. And so if you wish, I'm fine with you keeping in the first paragraph of number two and deleting the remainder. But if you want to delete the whole paragraph two, that's your prerogative as well.
All right. Well, you know, that's what I voiced before. We just heard Jim say he wants to see all of two go. I thought that first paragraph was useful because of the reference to the domain registrant impact, and also because it does discuss what IGOs do now in bilateral contracts, but then points out how this is different, and it doesn't go that extra mile that the last paragraph does in putting on the table a more sophisticated compromise cooked up by ICANN. Can I ask, so my vote, if we were, I don't want to say vote, let's get a sense of the room, if I can, just before we hear further comments. How many would favor deleting the second paragraph of two, but leaving in the first paragraph? Just check agree if you agree. So I see four agrees, and three out. And how many? I don't know if the others feel strong. Let's clear the agrees for that. How many want to see all of paragraph two deleted for the document that's before the participants in. So, wait, George, are you voting to eliminate all of two?
Phil, this is David Maher. I vote to eliminate all of two.
Okay, and I see George eliminating all of two, and we had Jim, so that's 4-3. The sense of those in the on the call. So I'm not sure what we have a split with a slight majority for keeping two.
But I don't think we have a majority. We can call it a consensus, Phil. So I think
what's that?
Goes out. This is Paul Keating. I don't feel, you know, with a vote of 4-3, I don't feel comfortable keeping in any of two.
Okay, and now
I mean we go on a consensus basis, not on.
And
a
now I think Kathy Kleiman and Rudy just chimed in to delete all of two. If I'm incorrect on that, chime in on the phone. Oh, now Rudy prefers keeping all of two in.
So,
and Kathy supports David, who wants it all out.
I think you take it. I this is Paul again. I'm
sorry. We don't have a consensus.
Out loud, and if you want to talk about the first paragraph of number two during the meeting, talk about it.
Yeah, we certainly have a consensus. We have probably an unanimity to remove the second paragraph. The only place where we have a split is removing the first. I don't know what we're going to do on that. I need to confer with my co-chair. If the decision falls to us. All right. Other
we have
1256.
So we have three options here. For those of you that wants to delete paragraph two in the total, would it still be okay for you at this stage to delete the second part of it as an alternative, or are you still hardly asking for the full deletion of paragraph two?
George Corico speaking here. Sorry to jump in. I would support deleting the entire thing because the PDP is really tasked with deciding first whether there should be an alternative, and the expert's report is kind of a part of our analysis of whether there should be an alternative. And then, you know, once we decide whether there should be an alternative that's supportable by, you know, the state of the law in the world, we could say yes or no. If the answer is no, then we stop. Imagine a flowchart. If we then go on to say then there should be alternatives, I don't think we should just be singling out a few that he's thinking off the cuff or prejudice the discussion further by, you know, spelling out what those alternatives might be. Because it kind of puts out a carrot to people that do want an alternative, that's what the expert is kind of suggesting, when it's really for our group to decide that.
Okay. And Mary just put, who should we? Yeah, I don't think we can ask for rewording at this point. I think it's either, strike it or not strike it, is my sense. There's 2 minutes left. As co-chair, the strong sense of the group is that the second paragraph of two, for purposes of having a document as a focus for discussion in Marrakesh, should definitely go. I'm in agreement with that. There's a split in the working group on whether the first paragraph of two should go. I think Petter and I will just confer after the decision, after the call, and make a co-chair's decision. There's simply not time at this point to do any extensive rewriting of this with Mary traveling today, I'm traveling tomorrow, Petter's traveling the next day, and then we're up to our eyeballs in work. So I think we're going to send a very simple ask to the professor, and with his consent, either delete the second paragraph or all of two. I think either way, whether or not the first paragraph is in there, in the course of that discussion, what IGOs do now in bilateral contracts and how that differs from the UDRP situation is likely to come up in the Marrakesh oral discussion. So, any final comments as we hit 1 p.m. Eastern and we draw to the magic hour? George.
George Kirkus here. I previously sent a link of what the four questions were that the expert was tasked with. Is the format of his document actually addressing those in order, or is he just writing a general document which answers them generally but doesn't go specifically 1, 2, 3, 4?
I have to look back at that. Do you recall, Petter or Mary? I know he lists the four questions at the beginning of the memo.
Petter,
this is Mary.
Go ahead, Mary. We don't want you to miss your plane.
He does list and refer to the four questions, but at the moment, the form in which it's written doesn't go question by question for reasons that he actually does explain in the draft memo, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, Petter, I just put up, have it in front of me. I agree with that. As you said, he starts with introduction of the questions, and then he goes through. There are, as I see it, there are replies to the questions within his report, but not that clear as question 1, 2, 3, 4. But he has dealt with the subject.
Okay. All right, it's 1:01, so unless there's a burning question or statement that anyone on the call feels they absolutely have to make, I'm going to propose that we end the call. I will have a back and forth with Petter. We'll decide what the request should be to the professor, and we'll advise all of you. And if there's right now, the working group meeting in Marrakesh is next Wednesday, at 9 a.m. local time, which I think is the same as UTC, I'm not sure. It's a 5-hour difference. So, and we don't turn the clocks back in the U.S. at least until the following weekend, or put them ahead until the following weekend. So thank you all for your participation. I think this was a very useful call. I'm glad we had it. Because it's certainly, I think, if nothing else, changing the document in regard to Section 2 is something that came out of this discussion. So thanks all, and we'll look forward to having you participate next Wednesday, either live in Marrakesh or remotely. And we can stop the call now. stop the recording.
Thank you very much, everyone. Christine, please stop the recordings, and this concludes today's call.